Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Every year since 2017 on November the 8th, events focusing on first-generation college students are held across the country. It's all about helping millions of young people who are the first in their families to go to college succeed in earning degrees and improving their prospects in life. First-generation students constitute more than 40% of the student body here at Eastern Kentucky University. This was hardly lost on Sierra Anderson, director of the university's NOVA program. Dr. Gil Hunter, Executive Director of Retention and Graduation at EKU, and the many others who recognize the need to welcome, encourage, and support these young people, many leaving their home communities for the first time. As a result, in early November, more than 100 educators gathered at EKU for the first conference in Kentucky to focus on first-generation college students, the first in their families to attend college, and what they need in order to make it all the way through to graduation. WEKU's Stu Johnson, Wendy Barnett, and Samantha Morrill cover the event, and we'll have their stories later in the hour. First, among the conference speakers was Dr. Aaron Thompson, president of Kentucky's Council on Post-Secondary Education. And he knows a thing or two about this subject, himself a first-generation EKU student from the Clay County town of Manchester. Greetings, Dr. Thompson.
Greetings, Tom. How are you?
I'm very good. And as I mentioned, being a first-generation student is something you can relate to in a very personal way. We've talked about this before in a previous interview, but briefly, if you could, let our listeners know why this subject is so near and dear to your heart.
Yes, thanks, Tom, for inviting me to be on your show again. In fact, it is near and dear to my heart. I mean, obviously, I represent all of Kentucky's students, and we have many, as you said earlier, that are first generation within our public universities and colleges, but also in our privates. But for me, I'm a first generation high school student. As you all know, my father was an illiterate coal miner, and mother had an eighth grade education. So going to high school was an immigrant experience to me. And going to college surely was an immigrant experience in more than ways than one, not just because I was first generation going to college. You know, I was truly coming in from some other backgrounds, being poor, to be honest with you, being African-American. So a lot of cultural inputs, if you will, within that institutional setting, and obviously received a lot of information in an overload fashion, being a first-generation college student.
I've seen the term breakaway learners applied to first-gen students. What does that mean?
You know, it means a variety of things. I've actually heard people use it in a variety of ways. For me, it means that what you've done is you've come out of that cultural background that was very much laid out generations before you of people not going to college, in many cases not attaining even a high school diploma. So, I mean, when you're going into a new setting, when you're going into a new atmosphere, a new culture, a new climate, I mean, what you're doing is you're having to adjust to that climate while actually doing what you're there to do and what you're doing with other people who aren't first generation college students. So breakaway learners for me, as I use it within the context of first gen, is in fact a way of creating a new paradigm, a new understanding of learning, a new cultural beginning, if you will, for themselves and their families.
Many of these students are first in their family, or they're all first in their family to break away from their communities and from their families and come to Richmond, for example, or to Lexington or to Northern Kentucky, Moorhead, wherever they go, to obtain a college degree. What kind of resistance do they face on the home front before they can even make that move?
Well, a variety, as a matter of fact, and not all the same, but I'll give it to you within what we know a little bit in research. What we find out is that in many cases, when you're leaving the culture that your parents and other people around you, your community, have learned to accept you in that culture, There's two things. One is that they're afraid that going outside that culture will change the way you're thinking, change your belief system, or change your moral value system, or change the way that you even view them. That's scary in many ways. And so they want to hold their children close to them, if you will, and not let that get away from them. The second thing is that it is truly, in many cases, you've heard that you don't want to get above your raisin either, which means that there is what I call a holdback. The idea that if it was good enough what I had for me, it's probably good enough for you. Now, I don't know how, critical mass that is of today, but surely it used to be more. And I think the idea that, this is a big old world out there, and we want to make sure that we protect our children and hold them as close as we can so that big old world doesn't smack them in the face.
I've also heard the concern raised that students who go away and get a degree really can't come home and apply their degree because the labor market is just not there. The jobs are just not there.
Oh, absolutely. And the interesting part of this conversation, I think, is exactly that. That what you have in many of the places, like where I'm from, I mean, the economic development system isn't strong. The workforce development system is somewhat weak. There's not a lot of jobs there. There's not a lot of other cultural opportunities. So if you get that certificate or degree that's going to help you to have a sustainable wage, you may have to move from there. In many cases, you will. And so what that's doing is depleting the talent, if you will, the brain drain, if you want to call it that, from those communities. So how do you build a strong workforce system if you don't have the people there that are educated to do so, but you can't stay there if there's no jobs? So that's another thing, sending your kids off to get that degree, even though you may want them to have that education, you ultimately would, in many cases, like for them to come back and have them to help your community to grow. And in many cases, that will not happen.
A moment ago, you touched on acclimation. When these students arrive on campus, it's kind of otherworldly. There are things to learn and to adjust to. What sorts of challenges do these students typically encounter when they arrive on campus?
Great question, Tom. Let me situate this in a very bifurcated way. When I was coming up, first generation, I was first generation of, in many cases, American-born people. We now look at first generation, many will not be, or many will be truly that first generation of a parent who may have been here, but immigrated to this country, right? So the first generation, about 25% of the population we're looking at coming out of high school, may consist of that group. Back in my day, it consisted of native-born Kentuckians, in my case, and native-born Americans. So what they can expect depends on many cases. What they can expect is they go into that setting, and it is an immigrant experience. It is a setting by which they don't know how to get the resources they need to be successful, how to go about finding the things that they need. In many cases, don't even know what they need. So this is why it's so important. And this would be exacerbated if you're coming really into a whole new cultural setting beyond just that of the college culture. So what this is calling us to do is really to be proactive as a resource person to all of those population groups, but understanding we have to be culturally sensitive and culturally competent in thinking about that, not just from a monolithic process that they are first-generation college students. They may be first-generation college students and other items that we need to pay attention to.
Why is it important to Kentucky, to our Commonwealth's future, that these students get the encouragement and the support they need to go to college and earn degrees?
Well, Tom, you cannot have a strong economic development system without having a strong higher education system and a strong overall education system. And what we know is that if you leave anybody behind, then, in fact, we will still use more of our money to actually contribute to the problems of low education, the Medicaid, the social welfare system, the prison system. So the argument is clear that it's important for us to know how to, in fact, educate, first of all. Secondarily, the importance of us to educate, the return on investment for an individual student, no matter what their background's from, is really clear. The return on investment for the state is really clear. I mean, you're going to spend more of your money advancing your state, more advancing more tax dollars in the coffers, more of an infrastructure that, in fact, is healthy, not only a physical infrastructure system for the state, but a human infrastructure system.
The 2020 session of the Kentucky General Assembly is coming up. And I wonder, what is your message to any state legislators who might be listening to us right now as they craft a budget for the next biennium?
Well, I think you just helped shape that a little bit, that economic development and higher education is one and the same. Both needs to be healthy, and one can't be healthy without the other, and vice versa. But to create a strong workforce, we're going to have to reinvest in higher education. And this is about, we've been able to, over the last many years without investment, actually being cut in many cases. We have been able to still produce, but we're now at that breaking point where you can't continue to do that. So the idea is to keep the momentum up, to ask us to do new things. Absolutely, we're ready for that. To be even more an important value, if you want to call it that, to that overall value proposition that education is good, but in fact that it's extremely good for our workforce and for our economic development. So that's what I want to be selling, to invest in our population again and to, in fact, invest in our physical infrastructure on our campuses.
Dr. Aaron Thompson, he's president of the Council on Postsecondary Education. We thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom, so much.
Coming up in a moment, some highlights from Kentucky's first conference focusing on first-generation students. Coming up after the break, we'll have three reports from this year's conference on first-generation students. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
As mentioned earlier, EKU in early November hosted the state's first conference on the unique needs of first-generation college students. The agenda was loaded with the many factors that impact students who are the first in their families to go to college. WEKU reporters focused on several of the issues discussed that day, and we have their reports, beginning with Samantha Morrill on the challenges faced by students who arrive on campus from foster homes.
Like other first-generation students, kids coming to college from foster care might not know how to fill out the FAFSA, what office hours are, or how to make a class schedule. But unlike many of their peers, some of these 18-year-olds, now considered adults, might not have a home to go to when the dorms close for winter break. Laura Vance is the director of the Student Success Center at EKU. She says circumstances like that mean many students just don't come back after the break.
One of the students that I was just talking about has left the university for a full-time job because that's how that student's going to be able to afford housing.
While housing can be a real obstacle, these students do catch one break. Tuition and fees are waived for Kentucky foster or adopted children. Tashiana Litton and her siblings were removed from their mother's custody when she was 8 years old. She spent the next decade living with different family members until she was officially turned over to the foster care system when she was 17.
I always wondered, like, how am I going to go to school? And so I feel like me being in foster care was like my step to, you know, be able to go to school. So I kind of look at like the brighter side of it and not just like the negative, because I was able to graduate and come to school for free.
Litton earned a bachelor's degree in psychology, and she's now a grad student at EKU studying mental health. Unfortunately, she's an exception to the norm for foster-adopted students. Stephanie Adams is a foster parent and director of the social work program at EKU.
Okay, so the latest statistics from 2018 are that about 25% to 33% of kids that either are adopted out of foster care or age out of foster care end up going into colleges. Of those, about 8% graduate with four-year degrees.
That compares with around 33% of the rest of the college student population. Laura Vance says part of the problem is that students who come from foster care or adoption often feel like they shouldn't even be in college.
And sometimes they just look for the first sign that they don't belong, and then it's time to move on. And so many students have been transient their whole lives, so they're comfortable with that. They're comfortable with things being temporary.
Anastasia Therrett and her two siblings were placed in foster care when she was just 11. She was moved from foster home to foster home for months until she was put in a group home, then eventually adopted when she was 14. Anastasia is now a freshman at EKU. She says she got used to moving around at a young age.
Always having to adjust to new friends, new people being around, new school systems, new dress codes, a lot of stuff like that. But for college, it was actually, I was super excited for it. I have been super excited about starting college since my sophomore year of high school when I decided I wanted to be a social work major.
Both Anastasia and Tashiana have come out of the system with a positive outlook and hope for the future. Stephanie Adams says that's in part because kids in these circumstances are very resilient.
They've already navigated a whole bunch of life obstacles and barriers to get where they are. And so when they get to school with support, I would even argue with minimal support, they can really be successful and really achieve to any level that they want to achieve.
Adams, director of EKU's social work program, says it's the job of universities, faculty, and staff to make sure these students have the tools they need to succeed. She says that means having resources in place and easily accessible.
And where they don't have to fly their big foster kid flag in order to do it, right? So one of the things that we can do is make sure that services, that there are things that students can find out for themselves without having to spill all their beans to everybody that they talk to.
Tashiana Litton says she struggled with trust while she was getting her bachelor's, and that made it difficult to ask questions and find help.
Because it's like people always wonder, like, why were you in foster care? Like, what happened to your parents? Like, what happened in your life to where you was in foster care? So a lot of people have trouble owning it, and I know for sure I did for like a while.
But now, Tashiana says she embraces it. She even speaks on different panels for foster care youth. Anastasia Therrett says she struggled with mental health issues and self-harm growing up in the system. She says it's important that adults approach kids from the system with sensitivity and respect because they'll notice.
They're going to see that first initial reaction, and it's definitely going to bring them down so much lower, especially if they see written on your face like disgust, hatred, whatever it is that you're feeling at that moment. Just try to be very like straightforward with them and that you're still going to be there for them.
When it comes to what universities and colleges can do to reach these kids and help them graduate, Laura Vance says that's a bit trickier, but not impossible. She says there's a lack of consistency. A department similar to EKU's Student Success Center might be called something totally different at another school. She says, though, that she's found it's better to send students to people, not offices.
If I tell a student here, go to the financial aid office and they'll help you, they show up and they just walk in, look around, and walk out because they don't know what to do. But if I say, here, I want you to go to the financial aid office and talk to Mr. Ursulin. He's the director there. He's very nice. Let me connect you with him. Then it's a human, and then it's a little different.
All four women made it clear that the best thing to do as a first-generation college student coming from foster care or adoption is to never be afraid to ask questions and to find a support system or mentor, someone, anyone, on campus or in the community that you can talk to, trust, and be open with. In Richmond, I'm Samantha Morrill.
Communication issues can present obstacles as first-generation students assimilate to campus life and academia. Stu Johnson has more.
Three Department of Communication instructors spoke on issues ranging from proper email etiquette to fully understanding instructor jargon. Krista Kimmel, senior lecturer in communication studies, says professors need to evaluate the words they use.
There are just terms, vocabulary, definitions that we use, and we just expect students to know what they mean, and they don't. So it's almost like students are failing a test that they don't know that they're taking.
Use of social media is prevalent for most everyone in college, including first-gen students. Like so many communication technologies, Kimmel says too much time on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook can carry with it some concern.
I think it contributes to the informal nature of communication, and I think it maybe contributes to the lack of listening. Because students and just people in general, I think, use social media as a form of just a platform, and it's almost a monologue, and we don't really listen to each other on social media. We just want to personally broadcast, and that's what I see as problematic.
But then there is often a flip side to consider. Jennifer Fairchild, professor of communication, says social media can be beneficial when students can message online and then schedule a meetup time in person. What Fairchild sees as a possible impediment, though, to positive give and take between student and instructor is a breakdown in email punctuation and grammar.
I really think that we just don't appreciate grammar anymore, and maybe I'm just one of those grammar snobs, but punctuation matters, grammar matters, being able to express ourselves not just orally but in writing needs to be addressed.
Melvin Diggs is a sophomore at EKU. Although not a first-generation student, he's a long way from home, about 7 hours to Greensboro, North Carolina. He says it's great when professors outwardly show support for students.
When professors come and don't just take everything super formal, when they become people with you, that breaks that ice right there, and it allows the student to be more open and more welcoming to the professor. And at the end of the day, more accepting to what they have to say.
The third professor from the Department of Communication on the First Gen Conference panel was John Strada. He participates in EKU's faculty and residence program. Strada says living alongside students offers those opportunities to break down barriers.
If I'm hanging around the lobby at 10 o'clock at night, you know, maybe at the front desk talking with people, a student may be more likely to come up and said, "Oh, hey, by the way, I have a speech. Do you have a hint or a tip?" Whereas they'd be terrified to show up to my office hours.
Strada says familiarity can lead to trust and comfortable feeling. He says the end goal is retention and graduation. A second first-gen session was listed as What First-Generation Students Need to Succeed, Voices from First-Year College Students in Appalachia, Kentucky. Heather Davis, the Associate Director of Academic Readiness and Retention at EKU, was a first-gen student. She says the hometown attitude toward a first-gen student that, in her words, you're getting above where you came from, persists today.
You just talk about how this is just another step. This is another step to create a better life or create a different life. No one's trying to be better than anyone else, but my path doesn't have to look like your path. It doesn't have to look like the next person's path.
Workshop participants heard excerpts from a video diary project involving Appalachian first-gen students. One section asked students to respond with three words they would like to hear.
Three words I needed to hear today were, you've got this.
The three words that I really needed to hear today when I looked at my grades were past my midterm. So
three words that I need to hear today is, God loves you.
Three words would be, never give up.
Invest in yourself.
The three words that I need to hear is, go have fun.
The three words I need to hear today is, you can do better.
Three words. Three words is, you'll do fine.
Wendy Neely is an evaluation consultant for Berea College's Gaining Early Awareness and Readiness for Undergraduate Programs, or GEAR Up. Its aim is to increase the number of low-income students who succeed in post-secondary education. Neely says sometimes the best advocates for increasing first-generation students are those same students.
These students were so anxious to be able to give back to the next generation of students coming up. They had so much information that they wanted to share. So their focus really was on, you know, the social and the emotional and the academics. What can I tell, you know, my younger brother or sister or my younger cousin or the next group of students about how to do this experience and do it well? So yes, are they enjoying their college experience? Absolutely. They were also concerned about making sure this information gets out.
Neely and other speakers at EKU's First Generation Conference spoke of students' recognition of the need for different study habits in college and managing amounts of money they were not accustomed to having. On the social adjustment side, Neely says there were positive remarks about opening up to new people and broadening understanding. All of these discussions helped paint a picture of what it's like to be a first-generation student at Kentucky universities. For Eastern Standard, I'm Stu Johnson.
Some first-generation students arrive on Kentucky's campuses already experiencing one of life's major challenges, parenthood. WEKU's Wendy Barnett.
Student parents not only have classes to attend and homework to complete, but they do it all while raising a child and working. Robin Moreland is director of the Center for Student Parents. She recently led a session called How to Bring a Baby to College during a conference on first-generation students at Eastern Kentucky University. Her center is funded through the State Cabinet for Health and Family Services, and she says it's focused on supporting student parents who receive state benefits, such as food stamps.
So our program is funded through the Cabinet for Health and Family Services, where we work specifically with single parents who are college students who also receive state benefits. That group of individuals are generally at a really high risk of dropping out or not being successful in college. So our program wraps them in resources and provides supportive services as well as work-study positions on campus to help support them through their college journey.
The Center for Student Parents also has a broader goal for single parents.
What we know about low-income families is that mothers are primarily the head of household, and so in order to move our Kentucky families out of poverty, educating and getting their mothers into the workforce with good jobs that pay a good income help to move families out of poverty. So essentially, that's what our program is doing, is helping move low-income families out of poverty.
The Center for Student Parents at EKU offers services specifically to EKU students. But Moreland says there are programs around the state for single student parents.
The other four-year universities that have a program like mine are Northern Kentucky University and Murray State. Then programs like ours are also at every community college in the state of Kentucky. So the entire KCTC system has a similar program to ours.
So how many college students are also parents? A report from the nonprofit research group Institute for Women's Research shows 22% of undergraduate college students have children. A 2016 national report shows that the number of student parents has steadily grown, even though the number of on-campus resources has declined. However, at EKU, the Center for Student Parents isn't the only resource for single parents. There's also the Eastern Scholar House. Director Melissa Gross says the Eastern Scholar House, in affiliation with Kentucky River Foothills, helps to provide housing, child care, and parenting classes. Gross says student parents who qualify must go through an interview process.
We actually do a process and an interview to have them come into the program, and then once they're in the program, then we can refer them into housing piece and even the child development center piece.
The housing complex of 39 two-bedroom apartments is next to the child care center for the convenience of the students. But Gross says it's not just for EKU students.
Scholar houses are for anyone going to school anywhere. So of our 39, about 28 of them are attending EKU, and the others are either at the community college or ones at a kind of a more technical school.
Director Robin Moreland says A little support can go a long way.
And then for a lot of them, they just need a cheerleader. You know, they need someone who believes in them. They need someone to help them walk them through what higher education is, through the challenges of financial aid or how to talk to your professor when you have a problem, things like that. You know, the resources and the support that programs like ours provide to students is often what helps them remain successful in college.
Even with support, Moreland says the student parents often need some help with basic skills.
Time management, being able to juggle home responsibilities with work responsibilities and school responsibilities. You know, a lot of us who are working moms know how hard that is. And then you throw education on top of it. So generally, it's the time management and the feeling of being overwhelmed.
Student parent Michaela Barentine says the programs have made a difference.
I honestly don't know how I would do it without these programs.
Barentine is a sophomore, has a 2-year-old son, and says that the programs have helped her learn the skills she needs to succeed.
I didn't know how to study. Like, I never studied in high school. I would say I was studying, but I would just sit there and stare at my books, and, like, I didn't really know how. I just, like, had to force myself to, like, learn how to study and how to sit there and, like, time manage to get everything done. And once I figured that out, it was so much better and easier to get the grades I needed. And it was so rewarding when I saw the grades that I needed. I was like, okay, I can do this. And then I just kept going from there.
And all of it made possible through the relationships they build.
That's what's so good about our community. Everybody here has gone through what you're going through. So if you're having a bad day, you can always go and talk to the people here who are here to support you.
For Eastern Standard, I'm Wendy Barnett.
You can read Wendy's story on easternprogress.com. Coming up after the break, a shopping mall of educational options, the University Center of Southern Kentucky. And
there are 335,000 Kentuckians that do not have a GED or an equivalent.
Kentucky Secretary of Education and Workforce Development, Derek Ramsey. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or on the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Something of a shopping mall of educational options is coming together on the campus of Somerset Community College. It's called the University Center of Southern Kentucky, and it brings to Pulaski and surrounding counties ready access to some of the state's leading regional 4-year universities. Trent Poole is its director, and he joins us. Thanks for stopping by Eastern Standard, Trent.
Thank you. Appreciate the invitation.
So first, let's go back to Square A. What was the initial idea behind forming the University Center?
Well, there were a group of constituents there in the Pulaski County, Somerset area, including our previous president, Joe Marshall, and community leaders in that area, as well as Congressman Hal Rogers. And so those folks came together and said, you know, we have a great community here. We need more opportunities for students to further their education, to pursue higher levels of education beyond the associate's degree within the region and have that accessible to them. So that began the conversation years ago. And then when Dr. Carrie Castle, our current president, came on board, those conversations built upon that foundation, along with the Founders Club in Congressman Hal Rogers and constituents there in the community of Pulaski County and Somerset. And the vision began to build.
Was there concern about out-migration and brain drain of losing young people from the area?
Yes. We see a lot of students, and I'm sure you see this as well, and students will leave their home areas, go off to universities and colleges and so forth and obtain that higher level of education. And a lot of times they find employment and so forth in those areas that they move to. So what we're hoping to see is the development of higher levels of education within our communities. So targeting those students that may not be able to move out of the area, have responsibilities, families, job ties and so forth that don't allow them to relocate for education, to have that access and ability to obtain that there locally. And in an effort to matriculate folks back into the region to develop our business and industry as well.
So in the introduction, I talked about the idea of a shopping mall for higher education. This pulls together, so far, four institutions. Which ones are they?
That's Eastern Kentucky University, Western Kentucky University, Morehead State, and the University of Kentucky. Those are our partners at this time.
And will this make obtaining a four-year degree more affordable?
I believe it will, with starting at the community college. Of course, our tuition is $169 per credit hour, so it's an affordable beginning of their education to earn the general education through us. Then when they make that transfer into their university through the University Center of Southern Kentucky, they're not having to pay for room and board, meal plans and parking passes and so on and so forth. So those are added savings for a student that stays within the region.
Will most of this coursework be offered online?
Currently at this point, the majority of the programs are online. We have criminal justice through Eastern Kentucky University that's on campus, and we're appreciative of that program. We have some developments with some other of the partners to provide some hybrid options. For a lot of students, online sometimes is the better fit for them. But we know that data shows that even students who take classes online pick an institution that's within a 50-mile radius of their home. So with that in mind, we also thought about, well, how else can we serve these students? Well, we can do that by providing the student services side of things. So having a representative from each of the universities on our campus in the University Center where students can make appointments with them and meet with them. So, for example, student is an SEC student. They're thinking about coming to EKU to major in one of the programs we've got listed. They choose one of the online majors. They still have an EKU representative that they can physically come to Somerset to our SEC campus in the University Center and meet with that person and discuss admissions and talk about financial aid and programs and who will be my advisor and that kind of student services information.
So there actually is that human connection.
There is that human connection, and we don't want to miss that part of it because we think that's very important to an education. And they also will be able to utilize our Learning Commons, which is our library. So they'll have a place where they can come and study, and so they'll have resources there, computer cubicles in our university center. So if it's a student who has issues with computers or internet access, they can even come to campus and do work, even though it might be an online course.
At what stage is this in development? Are you offering some courses now this fall?
Criminal justice has been there for a while, so that is an active program and going. The online courses, of course, are your traditional online programs that are accessible. So we have some things up. We have representatives from most of our partners that are now scheduling appointments and meeting with students through the university center. So we're getting started. I believe next fall will be a much stronger presence, and programs will be more solidified by that time, and we'll have a fuller offering for the students.
Your initial group of partners includes EKU, MSU, Western, and UK.
Correct.
What is it about these four universities in particular that made them want to get on board, want to get into this?
Well, they're regional in part. Programming-wise, there's variety for students and diversity and program offerings. And I think these universities also want to help us develop our region. You know, part of our mission is to grow and improve employability in our region. So we want a higher level trained workforce so that business and industry will look at us as a viable place to come and establish their businesses in our regions. Our university partners are interested in that and helping us develop that. And then each one saying, well, you know what? We think we can contribute in these majors, and we believe we can contribute with this area. And so it's diverse, and it's just an amazing partnership.
I've heard this described as a win-win-win, a triple win, a win for students in the area who might not otherwise obtain a four-year degree, win for the local economy, mm-hmm. in that it may retain talent, brain power, mm-hmm. And a win for the universities as well.
Absolutely.
Is that kind of what the thinking behind the concept?
Yes, absolutely. We don't want any of our partners and constituents in this development to carry a burden. You know, we want this to be something that promotes and develops all aspects. It promotes our community and develops our community. It promotes Somerset Community College, and it promotes our university partners. So yes, absolutely. We truly believe this is a win-win-win.
From what I've been able to read online about it so far, it seems as though the things really begin to happen in 2020.
Yes.
Where do you hope to be a year from now?
We are still in the discussion phase of many programs. I can't give you an exact number, but I would venture to say probably 10 or 12 more potential program options that are still in the discussion phase. And so by that 2020 mark or so, we're hoping to establish more majors for students and pathways and get those things promoted to the students within our region. And so I would like to be able to see a full array of offerings within different disciplines. And of course, all of those being tailored to what's going to help employability in our region.
If you're listening to this and you're intrigued, you're interested, I simply Googled University Center of Southern Kentucky, and up it came, and there is a wealth of information there to fill you in on what this is all about. Trent Poole is director of the University Center of Southern Kentucky in Somerset. Thanks for coming by, Trent.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate the invitation.
There are a number of reasons somebody might drop out of high school: to help with bills, to start a family, or simply because school just doesn't seem like the right fit for them at the time. There's always the option to go back and earn a general education diploma or a GED. But in Kentucky, a significant number of adults did not graduate from high school and do not have a GED. So in today's world, their earning potential is pretty seriously limited. I wanted to talk about this with Derek Ramsey. He's Kentucky's Secretary of Education and Workforce Development. And the state has a program that's designed to help improve the job and life prospects of Kentuckians who lack a high school diploma or a GED. Greetings, Secretary Ramsey.
Thank you very much, Tom, for having me.
And let's set the scene first. If you could, just give us a kind of a statistical portrait of what we're talking about. Give us the numbers.
For starters, there are 335,000 Kentuckians that do not have a GED or an equivalent. Also, that's 12.2% of the working population age of 18 to 64 that does not have a GED or a high school diploma. 55% of the individuals who currently not in the workplace. And also 16,000 inmates released from custody each year without a high school diploma. And so when you look at these numbers and the number of job openings I have, it is critical that we get these folk into the workplace. So there's 185,000 people that are out there that are not in the workplace and do not have a GED. Come next year, 2020, 62% of the jobs that will be out there will require some formal education. And so with this in mind, it's critical that we get our Kentuckians off the sideline and into the game. And so hence there's a collaboration between our cabinet and KCTCS.
You just mentioned that more than half of these people are not in the workforce, so
right.
Unemployed, I guess.
Right.
How do you motivate tens of thousands of adults? I mean, we're talking, if you were to put all these folks into one place, it would be quite a large city. How do you motivate tens of thousands of adults to make this kind of effort that could change their lives, to get a GED?
Well, what we're hopeful of is this. The jobs that are here today, 5 years, they probably will not be here. And so that's why I'm here today, to urge folk that do not have a GED to come in and get a GED. The GED itself, we pay for it. That's always a bit of a big stumbling block, and also transportation. And so we're working with different organizations to handle that as well. We're trying to take all the barriers out of the way possible so that people can have them. Part of the reason I am so passionate about this is because I am a product of a mom who got her GED after I graduated from UK. And so we were so proud of her. You know, and in our home, education was always in the forefront of everything. But once she got that, there was a joy, there was a beam about her, and a sense of accomplishment.
In terms of educational qualifications, do employers generally consider GEDs and high school diplomas
equal?
Six of one, half dozen of the other?
Yes.
But does it really say something to an employer that a person has come in with a GED? Because it means that later on in life, after their educational progress was disrupted, they became motivated and actually did something about their situation.
Well, to me as a employer, that says a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That says that, and as you mentioned earlier, Tom, people drop out of school for a number of reasons, and not necessarily because it was too hard. In my mom's case, it's because she got pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
People move. People lose sight of what's really, you know, important in some cases. And then people have situations where they have to stop out. Someone in their family got sick. The breadwinner dies. I mean, you could go on and on and on. So for me personally, when I see a person that has come back, let's say 20 years later, and they've been able to maneuver and provide for themselves and their family to this point. But they now realize that I keep hitting these dead ends, and I have the abilities to take the next step and the next step. But this is between them and a lot of times and that next step. So I commend them for when they actually decide to come back and do this. I'll tell you a story about a gentleman last year when I was at UK. This is most amazing. This young man dropped out of high school, and he was working as a mechanic. And one of the biology professors over at UK would come in and get his car work, and he would talk to this young man. And so he thought, this kid's really, really smart, you know. And he said, so he talked him into getting his GED. Then he talked him into coming to UK. After he got his bachelor's, he continued on to get his master's. After he got his master's, he then got his MD. And this guy is one of the top doctors in the country on CTE. I mean, I just believe that anything's possible. I believe that these 185,000 people that are out there, there are a lot of gems out there, and we just have to polish them off.
You also mentioned a few minutes ago when you were citing statistics that mm-hmm. there's something like 16,000 inmates who
right.
are released from custody each
right.
year
uh-huh.
without a high school diploma.
Right.
How about them? They're coming out of prison in that mm-hmm. condition. They're mm-hmm. already trailed by
right.
criminal records. So
right.
All that much more difficult to find
mm-hmm.
a job. Would a GED be helpful in overcoming that kind of situation?
Absolutely. I think. And the reason I think that is because, first of all, as you mentioned, they have this trail that's following them. It's called in prison time. And so as a employer, when I look at a person now that's come out, straightened their life up, gone back to get a GED, I think they're invaluable. I think they're invaluable. And for the chair that I sit in now with 153,000 open jobs in the Commonwealth today, I need all of these folk to participate in the workplace, because that number in the next 5 years, that number will possibly be as high as 275,000 to 300,000 open jobs. Fast forward that another 5 years to 2030, it could be as high as 600,000. So with that in mind, people with GEDs, people that have been incarcerated, people with disabilities, our veterans, I need all these folk to help me fill these jobs.
If you had to guess, what would you estimate what proportion of those jobs would a GED qualify for?
Well, there's a lot of entry-level jobs. But again, I think when people like the gentleman I just talked about, when you recognize talent, you want to promote that. Mm-hmm. And you want to encourage that. What I was thinking about earlier was GED Plus. It's a collaboration between the Education Workforce Cabinet and KCTCS. So when a person gets a GED, they can then continue on with their associate's degree that will be paid for in those five high-demand areas. It'll pay as the last money's in. We'll pay all of your tuition. And so with that in mind, that's where you start. You can finish wherever you want to.
That's GED Plus.
GED Plus.
How do you find out about that?
On our website, Education and Workforce Development Cabinet, you can go there or to KCTCS's website as well.
Derek Ramsey, Kentucky Secretary of Education and Workforce Development, thank you so much for your time.
Tom, thank you so much for having me.
And we'll have a link to Kentucky Skills U and the phone number on our website on the Facts and Information tab. That's on esweku.com. Coming up on next week's edition of Eastern Standard.
So the state of marijuana science right now doesn't really show us a clear path for any given indication.
Dr. Shayna Babylonis researches marijuana in the Department of Behavioral Science at the University of Kentucky College of Medicine. Legislation that would legalize medical marijuana may come up for a vote in the 2020 Kentucky General Assembly. A big driver is the hope that medical cannabis might serve as an alternative to opioid pain relievers.
The data on pain aren't that convincing right now. And most people want medical marijuana for the treatment of pain. Whenever you look at that in randomized controlled, placebo-controlled trials, the data really just aren't there to suggest that it's a very effective pain reliever.
We'll dig into Dr. Babylonis' findings, not only concerning medical marijuana, but also CBD as well. Also on next week's show, The Food We Eat, The Stories We Tell is a book about contemporary Appalachian kitchens and tables and the stories they hold. And an in-depth chemical analysis of locally sourced honey that identified the presence of heavy metals and pesticides in the majority of samples. That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on weku.fm, esweku.com, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we'd like to hear from you. Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.